side rail stared out over the rolling grey swells, what Scorgon called swollen waters. "If we had met in your realm, Hood," she said, "I would not have refused my state. I would not have sought to escape. Instead, I would have tried to kill you." "Many have, Captain. Good for them. Swollen waters. Hood, if she never discovers the truth, if she's made to carry that ignorance for the rest of her days, do you even care?"
"Do you imagine that knowledge would be a gift?"
"I don't know."
"The truth may hide at your feet. The truth may lie coiled in high grasses. But it still has claws. It still has fangs. Be careful, Captain, where you step."
"Food reserves are dwindling," Valash said, and then sighed and looked up at her handmaiden. "Straits are dire for dear mother."
She sat straighter, arched her back and groaned.
"Do you advise rest? These journeys through troubled realms, by Jaghut's cold breath or not, do take their toll upon my delicate self. But I must refuse your concerns, my dear. Necessity demands... Is that wine you're pouring? Excellent. I thought that long gone."
"I made a request, Highness."
"Indeed? Of whom?"
"It seems," the woman said, passing over a cup, "libations in the name of death continue unabated. And if the once god of that dread underworld is not above trespassing in his old, haunts, well, far be it from us to complain."
"Just so. Nonetheless, sweetie, I dislike the notion of you consorting with that hoary creature. Best keep a respectful distance, matching my own wise caution in this matter."
"As you wish."
"But I must say, superb wine, given its provenance. I trust you have acquired a decent supply."
"Luckily, yes, Highness."
"The other news is almost as dire, I'm afraid. We have cause now to mistrust the motivations of the Perish Greyhelms. Most disturbing."
The handmaid's eyes narrowed as she set to filling a bowl of rust leaf. "Are we not at this moment sailing to a rendezvous with the Perish fleet, Highness?"
"Assuming no calamity had struck, yes. But what is their disposition? The answer to that question is now paramount."
"Perhaps I could scry."
"No, we cannot risk that. The warren of the Forkerel Assail waxes full. Was I being poetic there, or succumbing to cliché?"
"I wouldn't know," murmured the handmaiden, concentrating on lighting the pipe.
"We have been careless in your education. Never mind. Too late now. For it is well known that a person's brain ossifies at a certain age, becoming incapable of new acquisition, barring simple matters such as languages, martial skills, and so on. There is a moment when true genius is within the reach of any and every child, and the gauge of that moment's duration is in fact the only means of defining intelligence. Thus, while you are naturally bright, and therefore it is probable that the time of your receptivity could have been measured in months, if not years, we have done all we thought to do at that juncture, and the time for regrets is past. My dear, what was in this wine? My mouth seems to be running all by itself. For most people, of course, that moment of receptivity was sadly brief. A day, half a day. And alas, once gone, it can never return.
Excuse me, Highness, your pipe is lit.
Good, give it over. About this wine.
There was a knock upon the cabin door. And a moment later the latch lifted and First Mate Scorgon Caban, the pretty, loomed in the doorway, knuckling his brow.
"Princess, highest of highs, beg your pardon. Got urgent happenings up top, if you please. Cap'n requests your presence."
Falash sighed.
"Very well, assuming I am able to, stand. Some assistance."
The handmaid reached out to steady her.
"Lead on, Scorgon,"
Falash said with a careless wave of one hand.
"And if you must ogle my tits, try being subtle about it, will you?"
"Sorry, Highness. Only got the one good eye, you know."
They paused and waited while the handmaid got over a sudden fit of coughing. Shorkalal turned as her first mate clumped up to her.
Captain, the squall witch, she's drunk.
Pretty, was that meant to be a whisper? Greetings, Highness. Drunkenness lies in the purview of the low-born. Captain, allow me to assure you that I am neither drunk nor low-born. But I must ask, where is our jaggered guest?
Shook grunted. Thought you'd have passed him on the way up. There is the matter of keeping at least one knife well hidden, you see.
No, Captain, I'm afraid I do not.
Ah, of course. Shork pointed ahead. We have been sighted by that ship, and it now bears down on us. Not a throne of war, Colancian, one presumes. Somewhat unsteadily, the princess made her way to the captain's side.
Oh, dear, she said. That is an Essail ship. At the very least, a lesser watered will be commanding. Most distressing, of course, are the implications.
As in, ventured Shorkalal, where is the Perish fleet?
Precisely. And if that is not sufficiently alarming, I am afraid that I have been engaged in exhausting rituals this day. If we must fight, I will be of little use. We have already experienced the danger posed by Forkrel Assail, by both their physical prowess and the sorcery of their voice.
I need no reminders, Highness, and while I proved immune to such magics, the same cannot be said for my crew. And now you tell me that you are unable to defend us. So much for hiding one knife, Highness.
We shall see. We have, after all, my handmaid.
Shook glanced over at the woman, recalling her attacks upon Sister Equity. She did not fare so well against a pure, Highness.
Well, a higher watered's Assail blood is, watered down, and is not quite as powerful. In any case, it remains to be seen how this will play out. After all, this could be one of the betrayers among the Assail. In the meantime, Captain, may I suggest your first mate gather your crew and make for the hold?
Scorgon, take him down and keep him quiet.
Aye, Captain.
There was something skeletal about the Assail ship. Two types of wood were visible, one bone white and the other dull black. The hull was narrow of beam and high castled, and with the two masts offering minimal canvas, Shork suspected that it had been built to ply sheltered waters. An open sea gale could well swamp such a ship. At twice the mass of her old raider, the Undying Gratitude, Shork judged it to have a complement of 70 or so sailors on board, along with 20 or more marines, and as the craft came around and fell off before the wind on the port side of the death ship, she stepped to the rail and looked across. A tall, spectral figure was staring down on her, flanked by two helmed guards cloaked in chain surcoats. A few paces behind the captain, Princess Falash said,
"Dearie, those marines."
"Yes, Highness," the handmaid replied.
"Captain?"
"Highness?"
"Why not ask them what they want?"
Shork turned to eye the princess. Before she could say anything, however, there were shouts from the Assail ship, and she swung back to see the handmaid scrambling up the side. Shit, wish I'd seen that leap. The craft was wallowing at least 6 paces away. "Princess, what is that woman doing?" The handmaid drew herself up and over the rail. The deck was an eye-hurting maze of black and white wood, like a shattered mosaic. 6 more helmed, chain-clad marines stood near the mainmast, now drawing heavy cutlasses. The Assail half-blood commander wore a heavy jeweled cloak. The thick oiled wool dyed a deep blue. Torques of gold collared her long neck, and her head was shaved, emphasizing the angled planes of her skull. She was unarmed, and she now faced the handmaid with a look of amused surprise, lifting a hand to stay her soldiers. Looking round, the handmaid saw recent storm damage. Much of the rigging had been torn away, and mounds of cordage and shattered stays littered the deck. There seemed to be less than a score of hands working on repairs.
"Inform your captain," said the Assail half-blood, "that having entered territorial waters, she must abide by the laws of High Colance. I am Lesser Watered Intransigent, Inquisitor of the Southern Fleet."
"Not much of a fleet," the handmaid observed. The Inquisitor blinked.
"A sudden storm has temporarily scattered us. To resume my message to your captain, she and her crew, including all passengers, must accept adjudication. By adjudication, do you mean killing? The pale-skinned woman smiled, the expression seeming to fold the two sides of her face slightly inward. The proclamation of restitution has been sanctioned. We continue the task. And did this fate befall the parish? Yours is not a parish ship, she frowned. I sense enmity from your vessel. And that fat little girl with the pipe, she is a mage, is she not? We shall adjudicate her first. The handmaid walked back to the rail and leaned over. Highness, she called down, there being a little cagey regarding the parish, might be you were right. Anything else that might be important? Falash asked. No, Highness, only that they want to kill us. Very well, carry on. The handmaid turned round. The lesser watered spoke. Reach not for your weapons. Kneel. For each and every one of you, the healing of the world begins with your death. Among all the reasons to die, is there one more worthy than this? Be thankful that we give meaning to your end. Kneel. The handmaid shook her head. A pure already tried all that. Caught me off guard for a moment or two. My will is not yours to command. She moved then, rather faster than they'd expected, her hands thrusting outward, striking the bodyguards in the chest. Both warriors were lifted from their feet, over the rail, plummeting to the waters below. She ducked at that instant, evading the lesser's lashing attack, and kicked at the second joint on the woman's left leg, folding it halfway between the knee and the ankle. Her attacker stumbled, and the handmaid slipped past her, spinning round and out to one side to meet the six marines. Behind them, others were coming up from below, she saw. She drew her fighting knives. She needed bigger weapons. The marine closest to her wielded a nice pair of cutlasses. She would take those. Shurkalal loosed a startled oath and then leaned forward to watch the two armored guards plunge into the choppy waters between the ships. Both men vanished in a froth of bubbles. Turning to Falash, she asked, "Does she need help over there?" Plucked brows lifted. I certainly hope not. The sounds of fighting, blades clashing, shouts and then screams, came from the deck of the other ship. Princess, this handmaid of yours, where did she come from? Ah, now that is a mystery. Enlighten me. Do we have the time? Well, I suppose we do. She puffed on her pipe, her face disappearing briefly behind a plume of smoke, and then said, My mother's account, this. There were seven of them. Six remain. The seventh, well, there was some kind of private challenge that, failed. No matter. Now, I will grant you they appear young, but do not let that deceive you. My mother concluded that alchemies constituted a worthwhile investment in maintaining the vigor of her six eldest daughters' handmaids. And we daughters are, of course, sworn to secrecy in all such matters, perpetuating the illusion that we have simply grown up with our loyal companions, and so on. She paused then, when another chain-clad marine spun head-first over the rail, trailing blood over the side. A loud splash followed. They were most recalcitrant about divesting themselves of their horrid masks, but in the end my mother's will prevailed. Shurkalal frowned. Masks? The sailors made a mess of things as the lesser watered, in her pain and panic, used the sorcery of her voice to command them. And it was some time before the handmaid worked her way through the howling mob. Frenzied rage had shock value, and the crew's utter lack of the instinct for self-preservation made things rather frantic for a few moments. But there was nothing tactical in their efforts to bring her down. When at last the handmaid stepped over a sprawl of bleeding bodies and approached the Inquisitor, she was breathing hard and sweat stung her eyes. The woman facing her cradled a broken arm, stood hunched over a dislocated shoulder and glared across at the handmaid.
What manner of demon are you? She demanded in a ragged hiss.
For an answer to that, the handmaid replied with a half smile, best look elsewhere. The Inquisitor scythed out one leg.
The handmaid leapt high, swung down, and severed the limb just above the knee. As she came down, her other cutlass cut into the vertical hinge of the woman's face, splitting it in two. A backswing with the pommel of the first cutlass slammed into the side of the Inquisitor's skull, punching through. Pouring out blood, the corpse crumpled at her feet. The handmaid looked round. No movement among any of the other bodies. Just as Mother taught. She glanced down at the cutlasses in her hands, and then let them fall with a clatter. Pieces of shit. She went looking for her knives. Hood returned to the deck once they were underway. The once god of death looked back, frowned at the burning ship in their wake.
"Would have stopped her firing it,"
Shurkelal muttered, following the Jaghut's gaze, "if I'd had the chance."
"Oh, why is that, Captain?"
"Well, that column of smoke can be seen from a long way off."
"Indeed."
And Hood turned to her then and smiled.
"I must leave you now," Ublala grunted.
"I knew you weren't my friend."
"I assure you," Draconis said, "that I am, Ublala Pang. But events have occurred that now force my hand. As for you, a different destiny awaits."
"I hate destiny."
"Do you understand the meaning of the word?"
Ublala looked across at Ralata and scowled.
"Of course I do. It's the place where you end up. Everyone knows that."
"In a manner of speaking, perhaps. I fear you have mistaken it for destination. Ublala, destiny is the fate you find for yourself. Many hold to the belief that it is preordained, as if the future was already decided and there is nothing you can do to escape it. I do not. Each of us is free to decide."
"Then I'm going with you. My wife can go somewhere else. She keeps talking about babies, but I don't want babies. They get in the way of having fun, and people who end up having them spend all day talking about how great it is, but they look miserable even when they're smiling. Or worse, they're those ones who think their baby is the god of genius reborn, and even its poo smells like flowers. And all they do is talk about them forever and ever, and it's so boring I want to run away, or break their necks, or drown them all in the slop bucket."
"A rather uncharitable view, Ublala."
"I don't give nothing for free, that's for sure. Whole people disappear when a baby arrives. Poof! Where'd they go? Oh, I know, they're crawling around making baby noises. It makes me sick."
He ducked the rock Ralata threw at him and continued.
"So I'm going with you. And if you were a real friend, you'd take me, because if I make a baby, my life is over. Over!"
"Can you fly, Ublala?"
"That's not fair."
"Nevertheless, and no, I will not carry you. Now listen to me. We have gone as far west as needed. Now you must strike northward."
"Why?"
Draconis glanced away, eyes narrowing, and then he sighed and said,
"Your innocence is a gift, Ublala Pang. A rare gift. It must endure. It must be protected, but that I can no longer do. Walk northward, that is all I ask."
"Where am I going?"
"I cannot say for certain," Draconis admitted. "Nothing is certain, especially now."
"Will you come back?"
Draconis hesitated, and then he shook his head.
"I do not think we will meet again, no. And for that I truly grieve."
"Are you going somewhere to die?"
"Do not weep, friend. I do not know what awaits me."
He stepped close to Ublala.
"I have left you sufficient food and water for a week's travel. Beyond that, well..."
He shrugged, and then held out a hand.
"Now, let us clasp arms."
Instead, Ublala wrapped the god in a fierce hug. After a moment, Draconis pulled himself free.
You give reason, friend, for what I must attempt. If sorcery must die, the magic in the mortal soul will persevere. Or so I choose to believe. Ralata hissed.
Kill him, Ublala. Kill him now. You can do it. Snap his neck. Take that sword.
Ublala winced and then shrugged.
She's always going on like this. She don't mean anything by it, Draconis. Honest.
He wiped at his eyes.
Goodbye. I'll never see you again.
And this time he burst into tears, wailing with his hands over his eyes. When Ralata rushed to him, scrabbling to draw his knife, Ublala batted her away between sobs. She was thrown back, sailing through the air and then landing hard, limbs flailing before falling still. Frowning, Draconis walked over, crouched down. Unconscious. Well, that is something, I suppose. Sniffling, Ublala said,
Women always get jealous about man friends. Sometimes they say bad things about them. Sometimes they try to knife them. Sometimes they sex them. Sometimes they run away with them. Sometimes they get so mad they just up and die. But it's all just stupid.
Draconis straightened, walked a short distance away, and then turned to face Ublala one more time. Be well, Ublala Pang.
Don't die, Draconis!
The god smiled. I shall try not to. Ublala watched his friend disappear inside a bloom of black ethereal darkness, watched as the darkness found shape, spreading wings, a long serpent neck, a massive head with rows of scimitar-length fangs, eyes of lurid yellow. The dragon lifted into the sky, the vast wings hissing with the sound of cold water on hot stones as the creature wheeled and set off. With an uneven sigh, the Teblor collected the pack containing the food, and then the heavy water skins. Along with his weapons and armor, the burden was enough to make him grunt when he straightened. Grasping Ralata by one ankle, he began walking. The way she was right now, why, a wife was as bad as a baby. Brother Diligence arrived well ahead of the retinue, his boots echoing as he strode the length of the throne room. All the bloodstains remained, splashed and smeared across the marble tiles, along the pillars to either side and the walls behind them, and upon the throne itself where sat Sister Reverence. Restitution had begun here, in this very chamber, and it was proper to remind all who would enter. Halting before Reverence, the only other person present, he said,
We must assume that they are lost to us, sister.
I smell smoke, brother.
Indeed.
Excellent.
She paused and then said,
Lost. Now that is a curious word. Are they dead, or are they now treasonous to our great cause?
If the former, sister, we must then reconsider the enemies arrayed against us.
And if the latter, then we must reevaluate the loyalty among us.
The issue lies with Sister Calm, said Brother Diligence. Equity but follows.
Not precisely true, brother. Equity is the heart of the ideals which they would hold, but it is Calm who adheres to the practical. Her long imprisonment, horrific as it must have been, has greatly damaged her spirit, I am afraid. We must indeed hope that she is dead, more so than poor misguided Equity.
I have received a missive from the siege, sister. The assault failed.
Reverence sat straighter.
But how can this be?
Sister Belai informs me that Akrast Corvalane is ineffectual against the commander of the besieged.
Impossible, unless he is a god, an ascendant?
Neither, I am told. This man, a mortal, titles himself the master of the deck of dragons. He commands the warrens in ways Sister Belai cannot quite understand. But what she describes at last explains the sudden appearance of that army. They arrived via a portal, traveling by warren. Incidentally, this is why they could not get closer to us here at the spire, where our sorceress influence is strongest.
I see. Then this master's power cannot challenge us.
He and his army represent a military threat nonetheless. I now advise we dispatch another 3 legions, commanded by another pure.
Ready the legions, brother, but do not send them to Estobance. Not yet. The challenge posed by the master of the deck of dragons intrigues me. I will think some more on how to deal with him.
As you wish, sister.
The doors swung open then, and Diligence turned to observe the approach of the retinue. Flanked by 2 pures, the heavily armored warriors marched towards the throne, a full dozen of the highest-ranking officers. Brother Diligence murmured,
"Most formidable, are they not, Sister Reverence?"
"Indeed, brother."
10 paces from the dais, the contingent halted. Brother Diligence studied them briefly, and then said to one of the escorting pures,
"Brother Serenity, they have anchored their ships in the harbor?"
"They have, brother. They are now servants of the Restitution."
Sister Reverence then spoke.
"Welcome, Grey Helms of the Parish. Your gesture has left no doubt in our minds as to the veracity of your claims."
One of the commanders tipped his head and said,
"We have discussed your arguments at length, Sister Reverence, and we are agreed. Our mortal sword committed blasphemy in swearing fealty to the Malazans. Furthermore, we are certain that our shield Anvil has concluded much the same, and that he is now at odds with the mortal sword."
"And who will win this wrestling for control of your land-based army?"
"There is no ambiguity, Sister Reverence. The mortal sword shall be made to accept her crime and do penance. If she refuses, she will be divested of her title and the privileges it affords. The time has come. The vengeance of the Wolves of Winter must now begin."
"All very delightful,"
Sister Reverence purred, and then she leaned forward.
"Unfortunately, the Fokral Asael demands something more than an alliance of forces that just happen to share, for the moment at least, a common cause."
She raised her voice.
"Now you shall kneel. You shall avow your service to the will of the Fokral Asael."
Even Brother Diligence felt buffeted by the power of Sister Reverence's sorcery. Against this, no mere human, no matter how pious or disciplined, could stand. The chamber echoed with the creak and clatter of armor as the parish warriors knelt on the blood-stained tiles of the throne room. Diligence turned to Reverence.
"Sister, I look forward to using these subjects, and it pleases me to know that yet more are on their way."
She nodded, leaning back.
"What are wolves but dogs not yet beaten into submission?"
Diligence frowned.
"Their cause is just, Sister Reverence."
"It is indeed, brother. But wildness is without discipline. Even savagery must be controlled, given direction and focus. We shall be the guiding hand."
"As you say, sister."
He regarded the still kneeling parish.
"You look thoughtful, brother."
"I was contemplating setting these warriors against the master of the deck of dragons."
Reverence arched her brows and then said,
"Brother Serenity, what think you of that notion?"
"I only ask that I be granted the privilege of commanding them, sister.
It is my understanding that the offending army is composed of Malazans, and I have a history with Malazans.
Send them, Brother Diligence. Break their defenses, Serenity, and if you can, drive them out into the open. I dare say even mastery of the Warrens would not save them then. At that moment, we shall discover what other resources the man possesses, if any.
Do you want him delivered in chains before you, sister?
She considered and then said,
No, his head will suffice.
The swarm of shards twisted as it lifted high into the air, blotting out a third of the sky. The shadow it cast spread across the ravaged, lifeless desert, flowing like black water. The scent of suffering was in the air, and the hunger of the locusts was, as ever, desperate. The shadow found the prey, but even the sudden cooling of air was not enough to awaken it to the threat fast closing, and the locusts rushed towards it. As the vast cloud hovered a moment, it seemed to tremble, and then out from its heart burst a winged creature. It plummeted down upon the unconscious form lying sprawled on the parched ground, and in its wake descended the shards, their wings voicing a roar. Taloned hands reached down, grasped hold of the body, lifted it effortlessly. Wings thundering, the creature rose back into the sky. Behind it, the locusts spun in confusion. From the body he held, Gurul could taste the flavor of life, but that flavor was weakening. He wondered if he'd end up delivering a corpse to Gessler and Stormy. It made little difference to the Shigal assassin. This one, this mortal sword of the Grey Helms, had lost her command, and such failures revealed flaws of character. Better that such flaws be exposed now rather than later, when the lives of thousands might be at stake. A waste of time, this. I was drawing closer to the enemy. The Destrian should not have called me back. The Shigal was looking forward to the imminent war. The bitter flavor of ancient memories remained strong in the Kachain Chimal. There could be no convenient rewriting of histories, such as seemed common among humans. No invented myths of past glory and honor that never was. The crimes committed back then were as sordid as those committed now, or those to come. And in the moment of slaughter, none of that really mattered. Who struck the first blow all those thousands of years ago was without relevance. The only thing that counted was who would strike the last blow. This contingent of Forkrel Asael, these pures so twisted away from their own history as to imagine themselves an entire world's arbiters, was perhaps the most powerful remnant of that species left. And could not the same be said for Gunthan Wandering?
Are we not the last Kachain Chimal? Is it not fitting that we meet for one more battle? A final clash between elder powers.
That this war would make use of humans on both sides was incidental. That entire civilizations might fall, or indeed every civilization, well, Gorol would not shed a single drop of oil in grief. Among humans, every faith was nothing but smoke, at times thick enough to blind, and at other times cynically thin. And every belief was a fire that devoured its own fuel, until nothing but ashes remained. As far as Gurul could determine, the only virtue humans possessed was a talent for starting over, with stern resolve restored in the sudden glow of renewed optimism, in complete disregard of whatever lessons past failures might offer. And he had no choice but to acknowledge the power of that virtue.
It is contingent upon collective amnesia. But as everyone knows, stupidity needs no excuse to repeat itself.
The body he carried voiced a faint moan, and the assassin looked down at her with his lower eyes. She had not fared well in her idiotic attempt to find the bone hunters. Gurul had found the skeleton of her horse less than a third of a day's march from the trail the army had made, and making use of the carnivorous locusts, he'd tracked her to the trail itself. He felt a faint disquiet at the thought of the bone hunters. High in the sky above the desert, he had seen their churned up, broken path stretching eastwards, hundreds of corpses and carcasses left behind. But he could see no end to that trail. Surely they must all have died by now. He crossed the edge of the desert, banked southward. "Reduce the rations again," Queen Abrastel commanded, and then watched her officers bow obeisance and make their way back to their companies. Beside her, Spax turned to glare for a moment at the setting sun, and then he grunted.
"They're suffering, Fireherr. The Bargast are used to such deprivations. For generations, we've been pushed to the poorest regions. We learned what it is to starve."
"Tomorrow," she said, "we shall reach the southern provinces of Colance, but I fear we shall find no salvation there."
He silently agreed with that observation. They had come upon the remains of refugee trains, camps cluttered with withered rubbish and desiccated corpses, fire pits filled with human bones, many of them belonging to children. Only yesterday a pack of emaciated dogs had attacked a Gilk scouting party, and every animal had to be cut down. Desperation had gnawed away all fear, all sense of self-preservation.
"We shall begin killing the draft animals," Abrastel said. "War Chief, I think I now understand the adjunct's recognition of all that we would face, and the manner in which such truths wounded her. We must divest ourselves of all hope of ever returning from this war."
He scratched at his beard, considered her words, and then said,
"The White Faces set out seeking a final battle, a moment of perfect glory. Our young gods stood before us, blackened faces smeared with filth, their hair the color of blood. From the deepest beds of peat they rose to confront us, and from the ancient burial ships they brought forth the finest weapons of our ancestors. Our enemies await us, they said."
She studied him with narrowed eyes.
"And yet you, Gilk, broke away. Abandoned the destiny that brought you to this continent."
"Ah, I shall tell you the truth of that, Highness. When Humbral Tar died, we saw the end of the Whiteface Alliance. There was no flaw in Onos Tulan, who was raised in Tar's place. Indeed, if certain rumors are to be believed, that warrior is older than our gods. And of his prowess with that flint sword, I have no doubt at all. No, he accepted the title out of love, for Humbral's only daughter. He possessed nothing of the zeal the younger warriors so desired in their war leader. His eyes did not shine with glory, and his voice, no matter how wise the words, held nothing of fire."
"In short, he was no politician."
Spax grimaced.
"You'd think tribes beaten down by centuries of defeat, clans rotted with feuds and mutual hatreds, you'd think, wouldn't you, that we'd listen to measured wisdom, that we'd heed his warnings against self-destruction."
"And if Humbral Tar had not drowned?"
"Even Tar was barely holding the clans together. I cannot even say for certain that his drowning was an accident. I was not witness to it. In any case, we Gilk saw nothing evil in Onos Tulhan, only in what was likely to be done to him. Among the Bargast, Fireherr, a leader is not simply ousted, cast adrift. He is killed. And so too his family, his entire bloodline is slaughtered. We Gilk would not be party to that."
"And did you warn Onos Tulhan before you left?"
"No, for it is possible that he would have sought our support in the power struggle to come. And had he asked, well, how could I have looked him in the eye and refused? It's my thought now that he would not have asked. But even then, it's likely I would have offered nonetheless."
She was frowning at him thoughtfully.
"You chose the coward's path."
"Perhaps you see it that way. Perhaps many did, and still do. But what I did to save my people. And this only Onos Tulan understood, for he did not pursue me, even when he had his chance."
"And now, Perhaps alone among all the white-faced Bargast, you have found that final war to fight in the name of your bog gods. He sighed.
And nightly I pray that when the battle begins, Onos Tulan will be there to lead the Bargast.
But it is not to be, Spex.
I know, Highness, I know. And the Gilk shall stand alone, the last clan, the last of the white faces.
Will you call upon your gods, Spex, upon the charge?
I doubt it.
Then what shall you do to inspire your warriors? He shrugged loose the tension in his shoulders, felt weariness draining in behind it.
I believe, Highness, I shall shame them.
As Faint swung herself astride the gaunt horse, she glanced back to see the ghost of Sweetest Sufferance standing at the edge of the camp. A shiver whispered through her, and she looked across to Precious Thimble.
Tell me you don't see her.
I don't see her, Faint. Let's go, else we lose them in the dark.
They set off at a canter. Overhead, heavy clouds obscured the jade strangers, enough to mute the green glow that had haunted every night for what seemed to be months, if not years.
Typical, isn't it? The one night we could do with that ghoulish light.
Are there rain clouds? That's what I want to know. Are they, Faint?
What am I, a weather scryer? I don't know. But I don't smell rain. I smell dust.
Thanks,
snapped Precious Thimble. Faint could just make out the two riders ahead, Bryce and Aranect. A Kell hunter had arrived with dusk, delivering a message scratched on a wax tablet, and now they were riding to the Chemal encampment. Aranect's invitation had come as a surprise, but Faint was eager to see these huge lizard warriors who'd be fighting at their side.
Fighting? Well, not us shareholders. We're just along for the ride, yee-haw. But a good look at the leathery allies just might put me at ease. At least there's one army that isn't starving and half dying of thirst, or so I've heard. But for all their complaining, and who knows there's been plenty of it, seems no one can get too heated up about it. Not with that Malazan army trying to cross a real desert, no matter how bad we've got it.
I still hate horses,
Precious Thimble said beside her.
You've got to roll with the animal under you, girl. Just think about making love.
What's that supposed to mean?
Faint looked across at her.
Gods below, don't tell me you're a damned virgin.
Then I won't, and no more talking about that. They're letting us catch up to them.
Ahead, Bryce and Aranect had slowed their horses to a fast trot.
The mounts are winded, Precious. We're all in bad shape.
Before long, they drew up alongside the prince and the Atricida.
Where's this army, then?
Faint demanded.
I thought they were camped close.
They are, Faint, Aranect replied. They simply have no need of cookfires or lanterns.
And now Faint made out a darker stain covering the low hills before them, and the dull gleam here and there of iron, or maybe reptilian eyes. Another shiver rippled through her.
How confident are you in these allies?
She could see massive elongated heads lifting now, eyes fixing upon them. She could see serrated rows of fangs.
They are commanded by three humans, Faint, and two of them were once soldiers in the Bone Hunters.
Precious Thimble muttered something under her breath, probably a curse. Aranect glanced at the young sorceress, and then over at Faint.
Do you share your colleagues' mistrust of Malazans, Faint?
Well, they tried conquering Darujistan once, but then they turned round and crushed the Paniandom in, and the Panians were headed towards Darujistan with bad intentions.
She shrugged.
I don't see them as any better or worse than anyone else.
Turning to Precious, she said,
Besides, I visited One Eye Cat before it got conquered, and that place was a hole. But at least it was my hole,
Precious snapped.
Did you just say, Oh, be quiet, will you? You know what I meant.
The prince and the Atricida said nothing and managed to hold their expressions, at least as far as Faint could discern in the heavy gloom.
Darkness, our saviour.
30 paces ahead, at the mouth of an avenue between ranks of silent, motionless Kachain Chemal, stood two men and a woman. The woman knelt and lifted the shutters of an oversized lantern, bathing the area in light. As the riders drew closer, Faint studied these commanders. The men were the soldiers, clad in the uniforms of Malazan Marines, and though at first Faint took them to be Falari, with that red and yellow hair, there seemed to be a strange hue to their skin, somewhere between bronze and gold, almost lit from within. The woman was a tribal of some sort, like the Rivi, only bigger boned, her face broad, slightly flat, her eyes dark and glittering like obsidian. Prince Bryce dismounted, followed by Erenicht and then Faint. Precious remained seated on her horse, glowering at the Malazans.
"Sergeant Gessler," Bryce began, and then stopped. "Are you certain you prefer that modest rank? As mortal sword to the—" "Forgive me for interrupting, Commander," Gessler said, "but Stormy insists. He won't even talk to me otherwise. Leave all the fancy titles to other people."
"He got busted down for good reasons," Stormy cut in, "and he ain't fixed none of those that I can see. In fact, he's gotten worse. If he showed up in a recruiting line right now, I'd send him to the cook staff, and if they was feeling generous, they might let him scrub a few pots. As it is, though, he's a sergeant and I'm a corporal."
"Commanding 7,000 Kachain Chemal,"
Erenicht observed, lighting a stick of rust leaf from a small ember box. Stormy shrugged. Sighing, Bryce resumed.
"Sergeant Gessler, your message? I take it she is awake?" "Aye, and she's not particularly happy. Commander, she's got something to say, something she needs to tell you."
"I see. Well then, lead on, Sergeant."
As they made their way through the camp, with Gessler out front and Stormy carrying the lantern a few paces behind, Faint found herself walking alongside the tribal woman.
"You are the Destriant, Kalith, once of the Elan, and you are one of the strangers who found the Lethary army. Faint of the Trigal Trade Guild. That miserable girl riding behind us is Precious Thimble. She doesn't like Malazans."
"From her," Kalith said, "the flavor is one of fear."
"With good reason," Precious retorted. "It's this war we can't make any sense of," Faint said. "The Malazans fight when and where it suits them. They're a damned empire, after all. It's all about conquest, expansion. They don't fight for noble causes, generally. Even taking down the Panians was politically expedient. So we're finding it hard to work out what they're up to. From all that we've heard, Kalance is not worth the effort, especially with a bunch of Fulcral Asael laying claim to it now."
Those dark eyes fixed on Faint's.
"What do you know of the Fulcral Asael?"
"Not much," she admitted. "An ancient race, back in Darujistan, where I come from. Most people think of them as, well, mythical, ruling in an age when justice prevailed all over the world. We've long since fallen from that age, of course, and much as people might bemoan our state, no one wants it back, if you know what I mean."
"Why not?"
"Because then we'd actually be taken to task for all the terrible stuff we do. Besides, being fallen excuses our worst traits. We're not what we once were, too bad, but that's just how it is. Thank hood and all the rest."
Kalith was slowly nodding.
"Then is it your belief that we can be no better than who and what we are now?"
"Something like that."
"What if I were to tell you that the Malazans seek to change that? That they seek to rise higher, taller? That once fallen, they now wish to stand? One more time, perhaps the last time, and not just for themselves, but for all of us."
A snort from Precious. Faint frowned and then shook her head.
"Then why fight the Fulcral Asael?"
"Because the Fulcral Asael have judged us. They came among my people, so this I know all too well. And in that judgment, they have decided that we must all die. Not just in Kalance, not just on the plains of Elan, but everywhere.
Given our history, that's not too surprising.
But, Faint of the Trigal Trade Guild, the Fulcral Asael are in no position to judge. I have tasted the ancient flavors of the Kachin Chemal, and it is as if that history was now my own. The Age of Justice and the time of the Forkrell Asael ended not at the hand of enemies or foreign races, but at the hands of the Forkrell Asael themselves. How? They judged their own god and found him wanting, and for his imperfections they finally killed him.
Ahead was a large tent, and the prince, Aranicht, and the Malazans entered, taking the lantern's light with them. Faint held back in the darkness, Caleth at her side. Behind them, Precious Thimble reined in, but still did not dismount. Caleth continued.
There was war between the Kachin Chemal and the Asael. The causes were mundane, a hunger for land, mostly. The Forkrell Asael had begun wars of extermination against many other races, but none had the strength and will to oppose them, as did the Kachin Chemal. When the war began to turn against the Asael, they turned on their own god, and in the need for yet more power they wounded him. But wounding proved not enough. They took more and more from him. The Kachin Chemal nests began to fall one by one, until the last surviving matron, in her desperation, opened a portal to the heart of chaos and set her back against it, hiding its presence from the advancing Asael. And when at last she stood facing them, when the tortured god's power rushed to annihilate her and all her kind, she surrendered her life, and the gate, which she had sealed with her own body, her own life force, opened to devour the Asael god's soul. He was too wounded to resist. What remained of him in this realm was shattered, mindless, and lost. Her eyes glittered. You have seen the glass desert. That is where all that remains of that god now lives, if one could call it a life. What happened to the Asael, Caleth?
The woman shrugged.
Their power spent, they were broken. Though they blamed the matron for the loss of their god, it was by their judgment that he was wielded as would one wield a weapon, a thing to be used, a thing not worthy of anything else. In any case, they had not the strength to exterminate the Kachin Chemal, but the truth was the war had destroyed both races, and when other races appeared through the cracks of chaos, which could now reach this and every realm, neither could stop the invasions. More wars, defeats, betrayals, until the age itself crumbled and was no more.
This has the sound of legend, Caleth, Faint said.
The memory of every matron is passed down in the blood, the oils, the secretions. Nothing is lost. Gantz Mak has offered me some of their flavors. Much of it I cannot be certain of. There was a time between the stars. I don't know. And it may be that I did not fully understand the tale I have just told. It may be that many truths were lost to me. Our senses are so limited compared to those of the Kachin Chemal.
You have given reason for why the Kachin Chemal seek to fight the Forkrell Asael, because their war never ended.
We are each the last of our kind.
Is there not room enough for both of you?
The Kachin might wish it so, but the Asael do not. Their memory is just as long, you see, and they do see their cause as being just.
Behind them, Precious spoke in a dark, gleeful tone.
You're using them, the Malazans and all their pathetic arrogance. You could change him, Mull. You're using them.
The Destriant turned.
Does it seem that way, sorceress? I taste in you the pleasure of that thought.
Why not? It's all they deserve.
If it is all that they deserve, then it is all that we deserve.
Just use them, Destriant! Use them up!
For some reason, Faint was no longer interested in entering the tent. She nodded towards it.
What's going on in there, Destriant?
Krukhava, once mortal sword of the Perish Greyhelms, speaks to Prince Bryce Bedict. She warns him of betrayal. The Perish vowed to serve the Adjunct Tavare. Instead, they will draw swords against us. They will fight under the banner of the Forkrell Asael.
Gods below, why would they do that?
But Precious was laughing. Caleth sighed.
The truth is this. The standard of justice can be raised by many,
and each may lay rightful claim to it. How are these claims weighed? Gessler would answer quickly enough. They are weighed on the field of battle. But I am not so sure. The parish claim to worship ancient war gods, and these...
Which war gods? Faint demanded.
They are called Fandaray and Tog, the wolves of winter.
Faint turned, stared up at Precious, and then back at Callis.
And Krukhaver was the mortal sword. Who now commands?
The shield anvil, Tanakalian.
And the Destriant? There should be a Destriant among them, right?
He died on the voyage, I am told. The position is still vacant.
No, it isn't. Leave it, Faint, said Precious. You don't know. You can't be certain. Don't be an idiot. You saw her eyes. Those were a wolf's eyes. And all her talk about the ghosts and the old crimes and all the rest.
Callis spoke.
I do not understand. Of whom do you speak?
Shit.
Faint turned back to the tent.
Seems I need to go in there after all.
The forgiving embrace must be earned, Shield Anvil Tanakalian said. Am I of such little worth that the cowards and fools among you can demand my blessing? He scanned the faces before him, saw their exhaustion, and was disgusted.
You come to me again and again. You ask, is this not the time to elect a new mortal sword, a new Destriant? Perhaps it is. Perhaps I am but waiting for one of you to rise above the others to show us all your worthiness. Alas, I am still waiting.
The eyes regarding him from beneath the rims of the helms were bleak, beaten down. The camp behind these officers had lost its orderliness. Discipline had given way to bestial indifference, the torrid pace of the march their only excuse. They had crossed the border into central Kollanz 2 days past, trudged down a road already overgrown, through towns little more than burned stains. This was a land returning to the wild, yet it stank of death.
It must be, said Tanakalian, that for now one man shall suffer the burden of all three titles. I did not ask for this. I do not welcome it. Ambition is a poison. We all saw what it did to Krukhaver. Must we now invite a return to that madness? I am not...
He stopped then, as a sudden breath of ice flowed past him. He saw the officers facing him recoil, saw a stirring ripple through the ranks assembled behind them. Mists lifted from the ground, curled and roiled on all sides. What is this? Who has come among us? He started, something caught in the corner of his eye, a flash of movement, then another. Lo, the whisper of fur, a lurid glint from burning eyes. Sudden shouts from the parish, the ranks losing formation, weapons hissing from scabbards. Tanakalian could feel the buffeting tide sweeping past him. Invisible forms slid past his legs, pushed him off balance. He spun round, glared into the darkness.
Show yourselves!
A figure coming up from beyond the road's berm, a girl wearing rags. But he could see the flowing shapes now, the ethereal forms surrounding her. Wolves. She comes in a sea of wolves. But they were not real, not living, not breathing. These beasts were long dead. They bore wounds, stains in the fur, gashes in the hide. The glow from their eyes was otherworldly, like holes burned through a wall. And what lay beyond was rage. Incandescent rage. She drew nearer, and her eyes were the same. Torn through by fury. One blazed yellow, the other was quicksilver. Horror filled Tanakalian at the moment of recognition. The wolves of winter, they are within her. They are there inside her. Those eyes, they stare out at me from the beast throne. Fandaray, Tog, our gods are among us. All strength left his limbs when those terrible eyes fixed on him and sank into his skull like fangs, forcing him to his knees. All at once she stood before him. Those fangs dug deeper, tearing into his brain, ripping loose every secret, every hidden hunger, raping him with cold remorselessness. As if he was carrion, Something washed back, thick as blood, and it was filled with contempt. An instant later, and he was dismissed, made irrelevant. Her gaze lifted past him to the grey helms, and he knew that they too knelt, abject, helpless, their courage drained away, their souls made cold with fear. When she spoke in their minds, the voice was a multitude of howls, a sound more terrible than anything they had ever heard.
"I am the voice of the wolves of winter. Listen well to these words. We will not be judged."
She looked down at Tanakalian.
"You would wield my sword, mortal? Are you the one to lay waste to 1,000 realms in my name? I think not. Pettiness consumes your thoughts. Vanity commands your every vision. Look well upon this child. She is Setok, Destriant. She is our voice. She is our will."
The girl raised her eyes once more, addressed the entire army.
"Your kin kneel before the Forkral Asael in the palace of Kolanz. The Asael would force the perished grey helms to serve them, and they eagerly await your arrival and the moment when you too must kneel in obeisance. This offends us. When Sister Reverence summons Destriant Setok, when she seeks to wrest this army from us, she shall know the wrath of the wolves."
One of the officers suddenly found the courage to call out, "Blessed wolves! Do you wish us to destroy the Forkral Asael? Did the mortal sword speak true?"
"Around us, mortal, there are only enemies. But we are among you now, and in the moment of battle the ghosts shall rise in numbers beyond counting, and before us every army shall fall. Before us every city shall burn. Before us there shall be slaughter to redress the balance. Think on your faith, my children. Think well on the imbalance of which I speak. The millennia of slaughter at your human hand. We shall give answer. In every realm, we shall give answer."
Before the power of his gods, Tanakalian bowed his head to hide his eyes. He was seething, his time of glory ripped away from him, his dreams of power stolen, his ascension left in ruins by this girl. She had walked past him now into the midst of his soldiers, but no, they were no longer his, were they?
"It will not end this way,"
he whispered.
"It will not end this way."
She staggered away, blood pouring from her wounds. Gruntal sought to rise, to lift his huge form one more time, but will was not enough. The pain was fading, a dullness seeping in, and in his bloodied nostrils all he could smell was burned fur, scorched flesh. The time surrounding him now, slowly closing in, seemed a force vast beyond countenance. It felt thick, unyielding, and yet he could see its expanse, the way it stretched behind him, but not ahead. No, there, almost within reach, it vanished into dark mists. If he could, he would have laughed. The irony of life's end was found in all the truths suddenly discovered, when it was too late to do a damned thing about them. It was said that in the moments before death there arrived an acceptance, a willingness to see it come to an end, and an indifference to the anguish and grief of the living.
"If I have let go, why can't you? It's these truths, you see, and my helplessness in answering them. I would laugh, but in laughter there is pain. I would bless, but in blessing there is loss. This is not how anyone wants it. But then, it never is. Don't you see that, Stonny? In all your fraught moments, and isn't every moment fraught, in all of them, you miss the chance of peace, the calm of all these truths, the ones us dying discover and even then we can say nothing, offer nothing. This time, it's all past. No, it's my past, and with it, I can do nothing.